before you. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Michael and Catherine.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Welcome, everybody. Let's get on with a really interesting hour of conversation. I'd also like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and acknowledge the importance of stories to all of us forever. Mm. Now, we should also disclose that we know each other, So, but I think that won't make us all cosy. I think we can ask tough questions as well.
Oh, yes.
Because I have been to places where you think, oh, those people know each other so well, it's really boring.
But it's easier to, when Catherine very kindly asked me yesterday, is there anything you don't want to talk about? I just said my standard answer, nothing's off limits, but it has to be about my books.
Yeah, I'm not going to go into too much personal detail.
But you'll probably find that I will probably go there. Nothing really is off limits. Okay. It's actually a wonderful opportunity to speak about storytelling. I agree with you.
Yeah. So let's talk about you first. Having said that, I'm going to ask you personal questions. Let's just try. So this book, Dirt Trap, which I strongly recommend to everybody, and I also recommend Tank Water, and you'll find out what that is in a minute, is set in the fictional country town called Kippen. You know, I googled that, and it's the name of a village in Scotland. You would have known, wouldn't you? did I choose that deliberately?
I did, because the region where I come from is called the New England region, even though the names are Scottish for many of the towns. I was born at a place called Inverell. I now live in the Glen Innes, Severn Shire. We have Tamworth, we're close to Aberdeen, Scone. Mm. So all of these places remind us of the old country. And I have very strong Scottish roots. I was asked to judge a literary prize at the Celtic Festival, the Australian Celtic Festival, which takes place every year in autumn in Glen Innes. And I suddenly felt a bit of imposter syndrome, and I must have expressed it on Facebook or something. And my cousin from Chinchilla in Queensland rang me up and remonstrated with me. She said, "You are strongly Scottish on both sides," and she sent me the family tree to remind me.
Oh, well,
and
that's...
I'm probably more Scottish than most of the people living in Glen Innes. And I've sort of, I think, one warring clan and then a sort of a postmodern clan, the Crawfords. So those names, I had to choose a Scottish name for my fictitious country town, which is up in the northern part of New England, not in the Tamworth Armidale zone where most of us live, but in the region where I live, which is border country, just south of the border with Queensland. And a lot of the small towns have Scottish names.
And when you say small, how big is it? What's the population? I mean, in your head.
Well, I think about it electorally because I'm a journalist. So all electorates in Australia really have to be around 120, 130, 140,000 people.
Right.
So that's why New England is so big, because we don't have a huge population.
Big town.
And the region where I am is mostly farmers. The southern region of the New England, Tamworth, Armidale is mostly businesses. And a lot of academics live at Armidale because of the university.
Yeah. So Kippen might have, 5,000 people? 10,000
less,
people?
Oh, less.
Okay, smaller.
Less than
more
that. Like Glen Innes is about 6,000 people. I come from a little place actually called Dalungra, which is west of Inverell. And if Kippen is anything like a real place, it's a bit like that. And that is quite small. So it's probably a town of about 500 people.
Oh, gosh, it is small. Yeah. So, but Kippen, anyway, we'll talk about Kippen a bit more. But you grew up there, but you came to the city, and now you're back in the country. Can you tell us a bit about that? Why you did it? What took you away, and what brought you home?
Well, me and my husband Richard, he is also from the country. He's from the Darling Downs, actually the Lockyer Valley near the Darling Downs, and I'm from the New England region. We're what's known as regional returners, so people who were born in the bush and have returned. And we're the highest growing demographic actually in the bush, in the country. And it's because we don't have those barriers that I guess people might have if they just moved out west. We know that it's profoundly dark at night. We know that, the roads, you know, the way people live, you know, that what to do, you know, you'll open and close a gate behind you. You won't let the sheep out. And if you see a stray cow, you'll find the farmer because they're liable if that causes an accident in New South Wales, not in Queensland. But also, so you sort of know where to stand at a livestock auction, or where not to stand and get in the way. You sort of know who you can talk to on a real level and who you can't. So that's the life we lead. And it's really, it's 10 years since the process of moving back began. I come from the farm that I grew up on is a place called Paxton, which is down the end of a lane with three farms, very similar, to the setting. It's very close to reality, the way that that looks in my mind's eye. And the driveway of our farm, Paxton, was actually the eastern boundary of a district that you'll know, it's infamous, it's Mile Creek. Because of the 1838 massacre, which was infamous enough for the killings that happened, but then it became more infamous amongst graziers because white settlers were, for the first time, tried, sentenced, and some of them were hanged for that crime. So it's interesting, I grew up telling people that I came from Dalungra because there became a bit of a tradition over the century and more since the massacre happened, that if you were from Mile Creek, you never admitted that you were.
Oh, okay.
So luckily we were right on the border. Now, no one ever explained that to me. I had to work that out for myself. It's because of the queer story, and I mean queer in the true sense of the word, not its postmodern use. They used to call it the sort of queer business of Mile Creek, which of course was a heinous crime.
Well, massacre, yeah.
And so Richard and I, and my sister and my mother-in-law, we went back to the Mile Creek Memorial, which takes place on the June long weekend every year. It's quite an amazing reconciliation project it's become, and it really has to be experienced to know exactly what it's like, but hundreds of people gather and remember. It's kind of like Anzac Day. There's usually a guest lecturer, and then there's a big barbecue down at the hall. I haven't been since 2015, but my feeling about that, my reaction to it, was that at the start, we white fellas were all standing in quiet groups and the black fellas were all standing in quiet groups, and then we all walked through the smoke of the smoking ceremony and had our foreheads marked if we wanted, and then participated in the ceremony by walking down to the massacre site. Well, when we all walked back, we were all one
mob. Yeah.
We were all one. Yeah. It was a really beautiful thing, and it's an inspiring thing. If you ever get the chance to go, I really advise you, if you want to understand what that story of the country where I grew up, Kamilaroi country, Gomeroi is another way to say it. If you want to understand that country, go. Don't just read about it. Don't read Kate Grenville's very admirable book, Unsettled, is one thing. But if you want to actually take a step to do something other than read about it, go to Mile Creek on the long weekend in June.
I think, I mean, that's not what we're going to talk about, but that is one of the things I noticed in both your books, is that you touch on a lot of different things, including Indigenous people, who you don't go into that a lot, but you mention it. But also, and I'll talk a bit about more about that later. But first of all, do we say, so I, as you can probably tell by my accent, wasn't born here, do we say country, which is what you say in the UK, where I grew up some of my life, or do we say bush? And if what is the difference?
It's Please. A good question. Or do we say the sticks? Or do we say whoop whoop?
Or the back of Bourke. That was a new one for me.
Beyond the black stump. Yeah. It's a very good question. I've never actually really thought about that. And I think it depends on which part of the nation you come from. I have a feeling that if you're from New England, you sound from the country because it sounds genteel.
Oh, it's sort of posh.
The bush, the bush is further west. The bush, the outback is certainly...
Oh, yeah, I forgot to mention it because the outback is another one. But the outback seems to me clearly a long way away, or delineated also by vegetation and...
Yes, yeah. I would say definitely, I'd have to answer that by saying country is New England. We come from the country.
Okay.
Exactly where the bush is, I don't know.
But you've said bush more than once.
Yes.
Your work really... So anyway, you grew up there, went to the city...
Oh, and the experience of going to the memorial, it really triggered this process of moving back to the country. And I visited... Me and my family revisited the farmhouse where I'd grown up. The people that lived there very kindly invited us for afternoon tea.
That's nice.
So I got to see the childhood landscape that I depict in James's childhood landscape in Tankwater and Dirt Trap. And it just started a process somehow, within 2 years, we had moved back. And if you told me that just before 2015, that I would end up moving back to the country, I would have laughed out loud, because I've been running from the country my whole life.
Yeah.
I've been running, and to be able to go back and live, it absolutely triggered a complete change in my creative trajectory, and also Richard's. We just, the quietude and the opportunity and the community has created much more of a powerhouse than we ever thought we'd ever be able to attain living in the suburbs. Absolutely.
That's really interesting to know. And then, but the other thing that I really struck by reading your work, I haven't lived in the country, but I do have we do have a property at St Albans, if you know where that is, a couple of hours from Sydney. So, you know, I'm used to tanks. I'm used to not having the city facilities.
Yeah.
I'm used to dodgy, to put it mildly, internet, which will be as well. But there are also, so there's lots in this book and in the previous book, there is a lot about living outside a city, which feels completely authentic. I mean, you've lived it. It's not like I better write in a bit of local colour.
Yeah.
So Tank Water, the title of your first book, I mean, who hasn't, you know, if you live outside a city, that's what you use and what you need. And in this case, Dirt Trap, you need to make sure there's no dead birds in your tank.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, when the water goes brown, it's a bit late.
Yeah,
really.
It's a bit late. You've got to trap the dirt before it goes in.
Before it goes in, before that bird goes in. But, I mean, beyond that, there's tanks for water. There's the cropping.
Yeah.
I went back to your first book, and the cheeky little crop of sorghum that somebody sneaks in before the actual planting season, taking a risk, as it might not work. The caravan park. Often there'll be a caravan park for people staying, but also for people visiting, but people who might not have anywhere else to live.
Yep.
The local pool, which is hugely important if you're not by the coast. Mm. The wooden bridge. Actually, I hadn't thought about the wooden bridge till I was in St. Albans this weekend, and we were celebrating a rebuilding of a stone bridge, and we looked up and saw the wooden bridge above us, and I thought, that's, you know, in this book. The local press, or lack of the local press, problem getting tradespeople. I mean, there's a lot of other things. But one of the things I'll mention, although we won't talk about it now, is one of the lines, and actually I've completely forgotten which book it's from, is one lonely Kippin farm boy in every generation kills himself.
Yeah.
Or does he?
Yeah. That's really the story of Tank Water, for sure. It's emblematic of the whole issue that these books are about, the crimes that these books are about.
Which are wrapped up in...
Yeah, mystery and sort of obfuscation and denial.
Denial, lies often.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So Tank Water, which we've talked about, was Michael's first novel. Why did you move from journalism and non-fiction into fiction? I mean, you do other writing as well.
Yeah.
But this is your third novel.
It's a very good question. I've always been a writer. I've always been a wordsmith. When I was at Dulunga Primary School, I learnt to read and write, as we all do at primary school, but they used a thing which you might have come across called a sentence maker. Has anyone ever come across a sentence maker? So it's a folder that you fold out, and it's in front of you, and it's like sort of like Scrabble or like stamp collecting. There's little shelves or slots, and they have all the words in it, and you literally make a sentence. And that's, I'll never forget my absolute delight at primary school in learning to read and write and form thoughts using that. And by the age of 17, I was no longer living in the bush. My parents split up. I said bush instead of country. And
you'll never be the same again now.
My mother was from the North Shore. She was from Cremorne. And so we moved back to the Blue Mountains. She said she couldn't bring three country kids back to the city. She thought we just wouldn't
understand. Cremorne might have been a bit of a shock.
Yeah, so we came right to the border. And in those days, in the 70s, the Blue Mountains was very, very rural compared to the way it is now.
Yeah.
And so at age 17, I embarked on writing fiction. I was just about to do the HSC. I'd studied judiciously. I was a deeply closeted gay teenager, so I had no life. And so I was a very high achiever in exams because I just had the time to apply myself. I was no rebel, really. And I thought, my gosh, I think I could write a novel. And I tried to write Tank Water without even imagining what it would eventually be, but I hit a snag very quickly, and that was, I already knew that in order to be what I would imagine is an effective, successful novelist, I was going to have to come out of the closet and be real about myself. I knew it would be terribly hypocritical to not, but I just had this innate feeling that there lies better fiction, is to be honest, better writing of all kinds. And I was too scared to. My family had had death and divorce and all sorts of stuff, and I just felt coming out was going to be more bad news. And that's just the reality for me. And so I just ran from fiction into other forms of writing, always wrote in corporate world, in broadcasting, on stage, and eventually found my way to journalism. I always was a journalist, I just didn't know I was.
Right.
I went to a very expensive private school and we had about 5 minutes of career advice,
yeah,
which was a multiple choice quiz, and I ended up with getting advice that I should be a philosopher. Which I laughed at and thought, well, that's unusual, and that was basically it. But in those days, in order to get into the country's best journalism course, you needed to get more marks in your HSC than you needed for medicine.
Whew.
And I did. I would have sailed over the bar into that course. But nobody
actually
knew.
Said that, yeah.
This is what closeting does to people. It shuts us down so much that even if someone wanted to help me, I probably would have run the other way.
Right.
It's the damage that closeting can do, and thank goodness it's getting very
better.
Quickly very
yeah.
much better. But I found my way to journalism eventually. It's just naturally in me. But I wrote myself off for writing fiction for years and years and years and years.
Well, James, perhaps the hero of your book, is asking himself in this book whether he should be writing fiction. If he tries, then he throws it away.
Well, there's one thing. James is a better version of myself. He's a de facto me. I think he's much better at journalism. I think he's better looking. I think he's a better friend. He's a better husband. But there's one thing I'm better at than him, and that's what part of this is about. I'm a better fiction writer.
Is there a competition?
Than he'll ever be. Because he does try to write fiction, yes, for sure. And I hope you snicker when you get to his sad attempts at writing fiction. I didn't realise that I'd done that, but I laughed and laughed and laughed once I realised that I'd done that to him, the poor man. But I thought, well, he owes me. He owes me.
Yeah.
So I got to writing eventually, and it was... I was glad, but I came late to it, for sure.
So this book is a sequel of sorts to Tank Water. I mean, you can read both books separately.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about how you link them, because I think you do that really, really well. But one of the things I wanted to ask you is, how would you compare the lives of gay men in the bush in Tank Water to Dirt Trap, which is how long later?
20 years.
20 years later?
Yeah.
What's changed, what hasn't changed, and what still needs to change?
There used to be this tradition that if you were gay, you had to get out of town, for sure. And, I mean, I'm talking going way back into even the dawn of our modern nation and into the colonial era, because we were beleaguered by the death penalty up until as late as the 1920s in parts of Australia. And Victoria was the last place that... would have hanged you if they wanted to for sodomy. The old sodomy laws from Henry VIII that lasted that long. They added gross indecency to beleaguer Oscar Wilde, and the Australians thought, that's a great idea, let's adopt that one too.
Put that one on, yeah.
And so everyone was having a pretty bad time. The year that I realised that I was gay is the year that homosexuality was decriminalised in New South Wales in 1984. It was 1981, I believe, in Victoria, 1975 under Don Dunstan in South Australia, not until 1993 or 4 in Queensland, Northern Territory.
Tasmania,
the very late 90s, and they had to go to the UN to sort of leverage that. So lives of gay men have changed across my lifetime. I was born in 1970, and I still can't quite believe it. We're almost there with equality. I think if we can knock conversion therapy on the head to make that criminal, then I think we will be in a much better place because it doesn't work. Mm. And I think there's a lot of institutions that want to, they believe that it could possibly save some of their poor sons and daughters, but it's an awful process. Mm. People often ask me, what's left to protest about? Well, it's that. That's the answer, is conversion therapy. If you want to write letters, write to your MP and demand that they
make it illegal.
Disallow it. Yeah, absolutely. So your question was about what's changed for the men in the bush in the last 20 years. Marriage equality is a major one. You know, it's how many years since that now? 8 years, 7 or 8 years since the legislation finally landed? If the Parliament had been allowed to vote on it in 2011, it would have passed. We didn't need that whole public vote. You know, we all had to ask all of you, is it okay for us to get married? Instead of going and asking our fathers-in-law, we had to ask the whole country. But we got there in the end, and there is a positive to that public vote approach. I really did object to it, like a lot of people did. It was an expensive way of finding out what we already knew. It was very damaging on many people in our community, their mental health. But because the people spoke, I don't think they'll be able to wind it back in this country.
Well, you can't doubt it.
Yeah. And to their credit, a lot of politicians who objected to it for years, the one that sticks out in my mind is a Queensland politician called Scott Buchholz, who is the MP for a big chunk of what I'd call Pauline Hanson country, that similar area of southeast Queensland. He stood up and paid tribute to the campaigners like Rodney Croom from Tasmania and Shelley Argent, who's a mother of a gay son from Queensland, who campaigned for years and years, and they were in the house when that happened, and he bowed his head to them and apologised for not listening to them because he acknowledged that they had told him that Australia wanted this a decade before, and they were right. Mm. But very few politicians actually went that far, and even though I disagree with him on many things, he had enough guts to actually make those amends to people who... I mean, Rodney Croom was a campaigner from Tasmania who had human feces thrown at him regularly when they were just having a market handing out free information during the HIV/AIDS crisis in 1980s Hobart. Mm. So he deserved that acknowledgement in our parliament. Mm. So those kinds of changes are what we've seen in those last 20 years. And for the gay community who were disproportionately impacted by HIV/AIDS, in the last 20 years we've also had the success of combination therapies that are keeping people alive so that AIDS is no longer a death sentence. Mm. And that's, I think, something that has kind of been a bit forgotten about. It's still a little bit taboo, but it's certainly, all of our whole society is better for those therapies because, of course, HIV does not impact queer people. So there's been huge change. But in the bush, the biggest change is what Richard and I have done, and those regional returners going back to the country. We arrived 2 weeks before the result of that survey about marriage equality, and we were slightly concerned how the New England would go because our leadership under Barnaby Joyce on that issue was really questionable. But we were a yes electorate regardless, and I really was so pleased to hear that. And I met him actually not long after that and asked him how he was going to vote in the House, because we got the result, and then about 3 weeks later they voted. And he scuffed his feet like a teenager, and he huffed and ummed and ahed and carried on. And I just said, you know, we've voted yes here. Will you
support us?
Will you support us? And he said, oh, I always said I'd never get in the way of the will of the people, and I took that as a good sign. But he was one of 8 MPs who broke the land speed record to get out of the House of Reps to keep their fingerprints off the legislation by abstaining. We were left unrepresented by our MP.
Your MP.
I have respect for Bob Catter in a way because he was staunchly against it, but he sat in that House and he voted no. Yeah. Now, I disagree with that, but he represented his electorate. It was a very interesting test of representation in a way, that whole experiment.
Yeah.
So there we've changed to the degree that but Barnaby Joyce and I are a similar age. We have similar heritage in New England. He has a parent from New Zealand. My mother was from New Zealand. We have Celtic roots, both of us, the Joyces and the Burgers. They're from Bingara originally. Don't believe that they're from Woolbrook. They're just pretending that they're genteel. we have many similarities, but we have very many, many vast differences. Yeah. But we now live in a world where Barnaby Joyce and his kind and Michael Burge and his kind can actually shake hands and meet at the ballot box and have a conversation without me and my type having to cower in fear
and having to hide.
Because he's got power over my dignity.
And having to deny.
Yeah.
And that's really what both the books are about.
Yeah.
So if we look at, because we could talk for hours and never get onto the book,
yes,
this
yes.
is just an interesting conversation. And just quickly, you've said, we've said country and we've said bush.
Yes.
And you've said gay and you've said queer.
Yes.
Now, I really want to ask you, and I've asked you this before, but I never used the word queer because it was tainted.
Yeah.
It was a word of condemnation and criticism. And yet now it's used a lot. And it's a generational thing, I think you said.
Yeah.
What's your view? Tell us.
Well, look, I embraced queer. I acknowledge that people of my generation and older have a strong objection to it because it was a really horrible pejorative term. It was used to cut you down at school and in certain situations and diminish you. But during the marriage equality campaign, there were forces against the queer community to divide and conquer us. And it was starting to work. And so we came together, and that's when I embraced queer, because I could not think of a better term that embraced every single letter of the queer alphabet, the rainbow alphabet. It's just growing and growing and growing, and it's become a lovely umbrella term to me. Richard, my husband, he can't stand it. He's from Queensland. He was called queer his whole life, and he just...
Yeah.
So there you go, in the same family. Okay. We just have that...
I just wanted to make sure, I suppose for me, but for everybody else, that we weren't saying the wrong thing.
No, no, no. And look, with all of these issues, I still make mistakes. I'm a queer person. I'll get someone's pronouns wrong and... I won't understand where they are on the spectrum, but I just apologise and ask them to correct me, and I move on. We move on. It's okay to make errors, I think.
Yeah, oh, good. Well, now that we've sorted that out, we can use the words interchangeably. But so let's go back. So we've talked about the past and we've talked about the present, and Tankwater is the story, and I will talk about Dirt Trap, but just so we go back.
Yeah.
Tankwater is the story of a young man who's a journalist in the city who goes back to the country because...
His cousin has been found dead in the reeds below this wooden bridge, this railway bridge and road bridge. But the awful part about it is that he has been missing for a couple of months. No one knows exactly when he died or how. So there's a real mystery there, and it's a shameful mystery.
And you talked about being closeted. No, everybody in Kippen at that time, which would have been the 19...
There's two late... time periods in Tankwater, 1985
and
2005.
So when the young the man who's found dead under the bridge was growing up, it would have been it would have been the 80s.
Yes.
And right. So
he was the favourite son of the town. He was the golden boy of the town, and there usually is a crew of them. You even get that in the suburbs, but in country towns, they're the ones who get the cheekiest crops and get the prettiest bird, and inherit the best land in the district, and learn how to work every single one of those situations to their advantage because they've always been upheld. So Tony was that golden boy, but he's the one who
dies.
He's found dead.
Yeah. So the book starts. Well, the book starts with James coming back, but that's in early 2000s.
Yes.
And this book starts another 15 years on.
20 years.
20 years.
It's actually set this year. I wrote it 2 years ago, and I was hoping that depicting dry conditions in early 2025 was not going to be incorrect.
Wow.
And I was proven I was proven right.
There's no flood at the moment
no,
anyway.
No.
Yeah. I thought a good way to start would be to ask you to just read the beginning. And well, we talked about which bits you were going to read, because it sets the scene. It talks about the first book. Just tells us what we need to know, but it sets the scene really clearly for Dirt Trap.
So we all know what a dirt trap is. The big iron tank that once stood against the homestead was always cool to the touch when there was water inside, but this modern plastic replacement needed drumming to tell how much was left. Habit made Daniel slap a hand on the side, one ear against it to hear the hollow boom. If the top inlet was blocked by even the slightest bit of muck, the rain would just bounce out. So he threw the bag of pointless presents into the long grass, ignored the pain in his belly, and hoisted up a ladder to take to the rungs. The view from the top made him pause. Always the golden fucking light on granite-covered slopes. Beautiful until a long wait for rain made it a harsh, dry joke. Daniel turned away and flopped his trunk onto the faded plastic top of the tank, scattering the butcher birds up the driveway. A few of them swooped overhead, took to the peak of the roof, then turned their heads to stare as he stretched one hand towards the tank hole. The end of his fingers brushed something, so he shoved his body forward, frustrated at the weakness of his arms after 20 years' retirement. This bloody inquiry wasn't helping. The best police work was always achieved on the quiet, and the last thing Daniel needed was the whole country seeing his mistakes in Tony's case. Once they got out, Jamie, the one journalist in a family of farmers, would lead the charge against his own father all over again. The trouble with you journos is you just don't trust experienced investigators, Daniel said, aiming his lecture at the closest bird as though it were his son. Just like Jamie, it fluffed its feathers and croaked out some back chat. Smart ass, Daniel said, even though Jamie had been proven right about the police turning a blind eye to Kippen's dead gaze. Daniel had witnessed all three broken bodies in his time on the force, and he'd never gotten over his nephew Tony being one of them. He groaned and stretched one hand into the tank hole, getting wrist-deep in muck, but Daniel's secret weapon was the old tin dirt trap he'd pulled out of the family rubbish dump in the gully down the hill. Round and deep, like his mother's trifle dish, its rim sat proud of the surface and dipped down to 1,000 nail holes that worked better than any modern sieve. Daniel's fingernails found them now, remembering how father had made him punch out every one with an iron tack, back when sons stuck around. Not like Daniel's three, one long dead, one lost to the city, and Jamie living up the road with Dylan making house at father and mother's old place. A dead something came out with the first scrape, drowned bird or crispy frog. He threw it upwards and it spattered across the roof irons before the birds dived for it. Daniel sat up and he saw Tony down below, leaning against a veranda post. He laughed when he realised it wasn't his dead nephew. It was just some other hairy head in the golden fucking light. Thought you were someone else, he said, turning his back. But he spun too fast. Grabbing for the ladder, the muck on his hand made it slip and hit the top of the tank. The rumble spooked the birds. Hold this thing for me, mate, Daniel added over his shoulder. The unexpected visitor lifted one boot onto the bottom rung and looked up. Daniel couldn't believe his eyes, because this was the bloke he'd been searching for. Didn't think I'd see you so soon, he said, chuckling because his knack of flushing out murder suspects was still spot on, even after those 20 years off the force. Oh, get us a beer, then you can tell me why you hung up on me last week. But the boot swung and a heavy jolt sent the ladder out from underneath him. A cry burst out of Daniel's gob. His arms flapped, but he dropped too fast to do anything about going off head first. The crunch of landing winded him, like falling under a scrum in footy. Then all he saw were birds squawking off into the golden fucking light.
So that's told us where we are. And it's also given us information that nobody else in the book has until a long way into the book. In other words, that there was a murder. They all believe that he fell off the roof, fell off the tank. He was drunk, it was Christmas Day, the bag of presents is fallen off. And it also makes clear that there's a perpetrator and nobody knows who he is, and we don't know that really till at the most, well, we don't know it for certain till the most confronting final scene. Well, not epilogue, but final scene. Yeah, yeah. So the thing you talk about, that one of the question I've got now is, why did you write a sequel? And I know what you're going to say, so that's why I'm asking.
Okay. I never envisaged that there would be a sequel. Midnight Sun Publishing in Adelaide published Tank Water. I was so grateful that they took a risk on that book. Never thought that the story would continue. But it was because the last scenes of that book are set in 2005. Now, 2005 was a pivotal year in Australia's judicial history, because it was the first time that we started to get real about what we call the gay hate decades. Now, this is a 50-year stretch of time which those of us in Sydney would be all too familiar with. Of course, the case of Scott Johnson at North Head in Manly, killed in 1988. The perpetrator of that homicide is now in jail for manslaughter. But for 33 years, it was considered to be suicide or misadventure or just a queer guy up on the cliffs doing queer things. But in 2005, Deputy Coroner Jacqueline Millage decreed that the cases at Bondi were murder, homicide, not misadventure, not suicide. It changed everything. It changed, and it's still continuing to change. And I was privileged enough to write stories about the regional and rural cases, of which there were a significant percentage in that list of 88 names that just floated in before our eyes for 15 years or more. Just these sort of abstract, sterile names of people who'd been caught up in this crime wave. And writing those stories, I used to post about them, talk to people about them. It was a great way to get leads about certain families who live much more remotely. I had to use the oldest trick in the book by calling up the post offices in certain places, including Bingra, where Barnaby's from, near where I grew up, to find some of these families. And so I was talking about it online, and a very savvy reader of Tank Water just asked me a question out of the blue one day, about 2.5 years ago, and they said, how did I feel that the fictitious Brandt family depicted in Tank Water, who I'd based in part on families that I know, including my own, so an authentic rural family, how would they have coped with this special commission of inquiry? Because Tony's parents, Bill and Doris, James's uncle and aunt, Tony's sister, Yvonne, these are all like real life people that I've met and interviewed, who've lost their loved ones in the most bizarre, mysterious circumstances, and many of them, the vast majority of them, still don't have answers about what happened. So it was a great question. And whenever anyone asks me a question, as I'm showing you now, I go on and on and on enthusiastically.
And the book is the answer.
Yeah, and I realised very fast that the answer was not a couple of throwaway sentences, it was a book. And that I had a wonderful opportunity to create a sequel. Thankfully, Anna at Midnight Sun leapt at the idea. I did not get a book deal on the strength of that conversation. She said, you'll have to start writing it and share it with me. Thankfully, when she saw enough of it, she said, yes, please, let's do it.
The commission in the book, you say, is not the special commission. But, I mean, we've all heard of what that was. But I'd just like to talk about it briefly. So what was it? When did it take place? And why was it so important for the queer community?
It was,
and why wasn't it a royal commission?
Well, I was just about to say that it may well still be. This is the thing. It was initially an internal review by New South Wales Police, which was called Operation Parabel in 2018.
Yeah.
The answers to that were not good enough, so it went to a New South Wales parliamentary inquiry, and the answers to that were not good enough, so it went to a special commission of inquiry. Which is one short of a royal commission. Now, we're yet to really understand what answers, if any, have come out of it, because very few of the cases were recommended as having enough evidence of what happened to reinvestigate. I believe there's around about 4 cases that are currently being reinvestigated.
Right.
It's what's known as Strike Force Atlas, and thankfully now there is also a committee, a public committee, advising the government to keep the pressure on those. Because remember, with Scott Johnson, everyone said, there's no way we're going to find answers in this case. The police never started investigating it as murder until 33 years after that man was killed. And yet within 18 months after they started to investigate, they had a suspect. So the thing about gay hate killers is that their profile, if we talk about criminology, is that They are usually 17 or 18. They're usually male, but not exclusively. And they always operate in gangs.
Huh.
And so...
as you show in the book, actually.
The chances of them still being alive now, if they killed someone 30 years ago...
quite high.
Is, so Scott White, who killed Scott Johnson, is actually a couple of years younger than Scott Johnson would be had he not been killed.
Mm.
So it's not always the case, but that's often the average profile.
Yeah.
So we're talking about possible...
So in this book, James is, a bit like you, is reporting remotely on the role, on the special commission, on the commission, which has its own frustrations if you're trying to do it from a part of the country where the internet could be better.
Yes, it is. And when I say it's not the commission, it's really only just covering my
yeah,
ass
yeah,
a bit.
One has to do that.
I depicted the emotional state that I went through watching it. I've still got a slight sore spot on the side of my hand because I depicted a scene in this where James just sort of, he has this involuntary reaction. He sort of hits his desk with the side of his hand in shock and anger because the case that he's hoping will lead to a reinvestigation is not recommended as such, only because there is just not enough archived evidence. There possibly would have been had the police handled the evidence
better at the time,
archived it and done a better job.
Yeah.
That's very real. That it was those emotions that I was very, very much wanting to capture.
And you do that really well. So that's a very, you know, as there are many other things that happen in the book, but he goes back to his room, to his desk, curses the internet, and tries to watch it. The other thing is that the sort of intermissions, it seems to be sitting less than it is not sitting.
Yes.
I mean, that's not quite right. But.
Yes. Look, the team that did that special commission did an absolutely incredible job. I suppose that's why I separate the two, because I'm showing some our character's fictitious frustrations based on what my experience was. But the legal teams, the councils assisting, the representatives for the police, the media liaison team, they were able to give the media transcripts almost in real time, which is incredible.
Amazing.
And we needed it. We needed it to be able to, because the volume of testimony was so vast. And it went on a lot longer than it was planned to, because new evidence was discovered in various storerooms around Sydney and other parts of the state, and brought, sort of dumped, usually on a Thursday, Friday afternoon, so that the special counsel assisting the commissioner did not have enough time to go through it before cases were heard.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a dog's breakfast in many ways, but at least the government allowed it to continue until...
And extended it a bit.
It was extended multiple times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you talk about, you write about James as your frustrations and the difficulties with that and the emotional journey when you're looking through, in James's case, he is looking at his town and the men he's sure were victims of gay hate crimes.
Yeah.
He can't prove it, but he's pretty sure they are.
Yeah.
So, for the families of those disappeared, dead, murdered or not men, they have a roller coaster journey as well.
Very much so, and I think that's the main theme of Dirt Trap, is what these... as a journalist, I did what a lot of journalists do when we get the chance to meet people in those situations, and not just with gay hate crime, but missing persons and old homicide cases, cold cases. They usually get asked, when will you know that you'll get a sense of justice? What will justice look like for you? And I came to understand it's actually quite a cruel question, because justice is a very, very elusive state. It's one of those very rare words in the English language that it doesn't really have a synonym. So revenge is not exactly justice. Retribution is not really justice. The restoration of order is a big thing in crime fiction. It's a hallmark, isn't it, of crime fiction, that the cozier the crime novel, the greater order usually gets restored at the end. And a crime novel, I think, is one of the best vessels to look at the gay hate decades through, because I am compelled, in a way, to take care of readers by trying to find justice and restore a little bit of order. But the only way I ever found to do that was with hope. And hope, to me, is a form of justice being restored. It's hope has great potential. We're forever. I mean, think of the last time you felt hopeful. I know that's as rare as justice in a way sometimes, hope. But hope's very powerful. Hope can bring justice. So I really embrace the opportunity that there's a hope for justice.
And there's also, it seems to me, that some of the parents, Tony's mother,
Doris, yeah,
is, and his sister, that it's not easy. It's not as if they're, it's almost, it, there's a way in which they'd like it all to go away.
Yeah.
Not obviously not to have happened, but they're not altogether positive about the commission, are they?
No. I think it's...
And explain some of that.
It's because...
Oh, you would have talked to lots of people who felt that.
Yeah, people... There's a certain shame and stigma which comes from, not from the sexual orientation of the deceased person, but from not having answers to give around the dinner table when people ask. So people stop talking about these lost loved ones. And it must be so very painful when you're not able to provide answers. And I learnt the story of one of the mothers of the deceased men. So you might be aware, I know most of you would be aware of Scott Johnson, but also Ross Warren, who was a newsreader for Wynn Television in Wollongong. Now, his body has never been found, but he disappeared off Marks Park in Bondi. He's probably more well-known than some others because he was an incredibly handsome man. Now, his family was from the Gold Coast, from regional part of Queensland, and his mother, Kay, who I believe is still alive, but I'm not quite sure, but she has purposely kept herself away from the media for very understandable reasons. And she just wrote every year to the police who dealt with the apparent suicide of her son. His car was found and the keys were found on the rocks. She just wrote because all she wanted was a death certificate so she could acquit the death of her son, one of her children, her beloved son. But she's been mischaracterized as harassing the police. And she said, no, I just occasionally wrote them a letter. Eventually, one of her letters made it onto the desk of Stephen Page, who was a serving officer who is just one of those men that has an abundance of empathy. Thank goodness for him. But thank goodness Kay kept it up because I really, personally, I've never met Kay. I would love the chance to meet her, to thank her one day, because I really do believe that she is responsible
for the rest.
Yeah. Because if she hadn't continued to write letters, then the cases at Bondi would probably never
not
have been
investigated.
Yeah. And it was those cases at Bondi that Scott Johnson's surviving spouse, Michael Noon, sent the clippings of those stories to Steve Johnson in America, who was Scott Johnson's brother.
And that inspired him to continue to find, and you'd
all be aware of the rest of that story. Yeah. So to answer your question, it's the Kay Warrens, the unsung heroes of these real-life cases that inspired me to create Doris's response and Yvonne's response, these quiet responses of country women who, let's face it, they have always been and always will be incredibly stoic, but incredible deep emotions run there.
Yeah. And there's a real weariness in Doris. You feel she's just weary of all this. But so I'm realizing we're making this not sound like a novel, but it is a novel.
Yes.
And
it is.
So, and you saw how at the beginning that there's this bloody royal commission image that's not making life any easier. So there's that going on, and James is really involved in that. But at the same time, some people who'd left the town 20 years before come back, the Jones family. Why is that relevant? Well, and that really kicks everything off.
It does, yeah. It's the Jones family are... Oh, where did they come from in my mind? I can think of... Growing up in Dalunga, I can think of various notorious families around town that sort of were, people spoke ill of. Perhaps their kids got into trouble a bit more than other kids, or perhaps they didn't get let off by the local cops as much as other kids did. And they got a bit of a bad reputation. They're often what we call townies, so they work in town. They might run a business in town or work for council.
So they're not farmers.
Yeah, they're not farmers, not graziers. I mean, there are sort of artificial hierarchies in country towns for sure, whereas the Brants very much are graziers, and so there is that divide. And so it really doesn't give you a spoiler to tell you that it's the Jones family who kind of escaped being brought and held to account. And James is really the only one in 2025 who is like, are we crazy? Why are we not getting that family and putting them in front of the cops now that they're back? They return to
town. There's an irony in that. Do you want to mention it or...?
Tell me. You know, you tell me. What is it?
Well, put me on the spot now. The family have... I don't think we met his wife.
Oh, I get you. Yeah. They, like so many families I've seen over the years, including my own, we have members of our family who can be described broadly as queerphobic, who have someone queer come out in their family. And that happens to the Joneses, and of course they have something in common with the Brants, finally, and yet they're still very much polar opposite. So it's that commonality that we explore. It comes into the investigation of the potential crimes. It comes into James's ability to just be nice to the Jones family for once, instead of being so bloody awful to them. And it calls on everybody in that community to actually stop their old ways of communicating and just...
And look at the truth. That their return sparks off more murders.
Yeah.
And we don't know about the first murder because we know, but the people in the town don't. Yeah. Yeah. So there's actually already been a murder.
Yeah.
Had they arrived back when that... Yes, they had. Or no, hadn't. No, it was just before. A lot of new people come back to Joneses. Another man comes back, but also there are new people in town. There's the podcaster, who sort of fetches up.
James is no longer the only gay in the village.
He's not.
And he's no longer the only journo around the traps either. And
that has its own tensions.
He doesn't like it.
Does he?
He's slightly
out of joint.
Yeah. Like a lot of us journos, we sort of look at podcasting and go, it's just slightly cheating, really, just stick a microphone out and record it and edit it later. How easy is that? The podcaster in Dirt Trap is a character called Rita Dillon, who I absolutely love. She's the beating heart, in a way, of the book, even though James is the protagonist. And I really enjoyed creating Rita because she is a foil. She sort of digs away. It's me digging away at my alter ego. It's Rita.
And she plays a very important role. Which comes out again later on. There's also a policewoman in town, but another, I think, reflection of your knowledge of the country is that a lot of the rural police stations have been closed. And the Kippen police station is no more. So this woman has to be sent from...
Northern Rivers, the Northern Area Command. So that is reflective of the truth. We had a very terrible crime take place in Glen Innes about 5 or 6 years ago. Two police officers were shot with the same bullet at almost point-blank range. They both survived. They're both, particularly the first one who received the bullet that went through him, had many more profound injuries. But Richard and I live at Deepwater, which is about 45 minutes north of Glen Innes. And at about 2 in the morning, we heard the sirens coming. We had no idea what had happened, but we heard the siren coming from the north. And it woke us up because we're fairly close to the highway. Mm. And we heard it rush past our house and go south. And I said, there's something terrible is going to happen. So the incident happened in Glen Innes, no police in Glen Innes, none in Deepwater, none in Inverell because they were renovating the police station. Goodness knows where they were at Armidale. Was Tamworth closer than Tenterfield? Well, when the emergency call came through, they picked it up at Tenterfield, so bad luck for them. They had to go and
they
do
had to
it.
Go and do, yeah.
Kippen, in my mind, is closer geographically to a part of the country where there's a town you might have heard called Ashford. I didn't base it on Ashford. I don't want to besmirch the good people of Ashford. But they live fairly remotely from all police, like at some points in time, maybe 3 to 4 hours from the closest on-duty police officers. And I think it's pretty bad, really.
Yeah.
But at any given time, the police, New South Wales police, has a deficit of around about 1,000 police officers that they need. And that's not just in the bush, but in the bush, yeah, it's the
much
distances.
Worse. But yeah, also, if you haven't got a police station, I mean, in St Albans, that now nearest police station is Wiseman's Ferry, but it's not. There's one policeman, and he's not always there.
Yeah.
So you get put through to Windsor, which is another hour away, 45 minutes away.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, you kind of don't want to call the police for things that might be trivial.
Yes.
But that, so she's another incomer.
Yeah.
Temporary incomer. And there's also an app. Tell us about the app and why it's so important.
It's a dating app. Now, I personally have never used a dating app of any stripe, but in the queer community, there is a dating app called Grindr, which gets used quite a lot. And I'd never heard of this until Richard and I were at a dinner party maybe over 10 years ago, and someone asked, "Are you on Grindr?" We said, What's Grindr?
Like, got laughed at.
And it's, so there is an app used in Dirt Trap, and I thought of it as a device, really, because you know, these dating apps can actually track where you are. And you might have heard a couple of weeks ago there were some teenagers sentenced for using Grindr to entrap gay men and physically assault them. And these kids were actually hauled in front of the courts and they've been sentenced. I don't know what the sentencing was. But that's been around as long as dating apps have been, not just for the queer community. It can be quite dangerous. But I thought of it as a device, and I didn't want to sort of... I never want rural crime stories to be all doom and gloom. I do like a little bit of lightness. Mm. And I think the dating app creates a few...
Yeah. It creates some funny situations.
Yeah, amongst people.
And good situations. I mean, So, yeah, that's the... I've just realised the time. That's the nexus. The situation. There's murders in the past. There are murders in the present, and they're all linked in some ways, which is unravelled, and it's really... It's not a happy ending, but it's happier than at the beginning. And there's hope, I think, as you said.
Yeah. I think so. And it's, you know, if you take up Catherine's recommendation and read it, I'd, you know, and you feel like writing to me about whether you felt it portrayed justice or inspired hope for the characters, I'd love to hear from you, because I don't have all the answers about justice in Australia, for sure. I think we're on a big journey.
Yeah,
our whole post-colonial journey is
many different ways.
Yeah.
Do you have any other? Do you have any questions? I'll give you a minute. Oh, yes.
Do you see yourself writing a sequel to this book?
Yeah, I was just going to ask that.
I think that, quite honestly, I would have to live 20 more years and write it then, because I've sort of caught up with myself. So James and I are 55. So. Never say never, but there is a possibility of writing a short story, a shorter piece around James, and I don't quite know where that fits into the story yet, but we'll see. I mean, the new evidence is coming to light all the time in the real life cases, and as I said, the Royal Commission may well result. Who knows? But yeah, I've learned to never say never with that.
Absolutely.
Precedent. Yeah.
So one of the things. Oh, sorry.
I'd like to ask about your work with the police. Do you actually work personally with the criminal scene, or do you take a distance?
I've always been, like, journalists always have easy access if the police in the region that you're working will sit down with you for half an hour, middle of the week, and give you the police rounds, we call it. So they update us about cases of. Depends on the area you're in. Like, some newspapers I've worked for, they want you to cover every crime where someone was trapped in the car, every car crash where someone was trapped in a car. Some of them in Glenis, they just want to know every fire that happened in town. That's what people want to know. Some police rounds, all they want to know is the break-ins and the batteries and that sort of thing. So my work with police as a journalist is always around that sort of, we want the news, they deliver it. There's police media, which is one way to get it, which I portray in Dirt Trap, the sort of media websites, we can all go and you can see the latest press releases every day, every crime that's happening. But personally working with police, no, I have not. I have friends who are former police officers and they were a really great source of information. Because by the time I researched the way police work, I couldn't not believe how, I'm trying to think of the right word here, their protocols are so measured that it's, you basically follow a guidebook. If this happens, turn to page 47, turn here. That's what you do, you follow that standard. It was Danuka McKenzie who I've talked to about this, and she, another crime writer who you surely will have heard of, and she's, because she works in the public service and has, she said that we always forget that police work in the public service, yeah. And so they have guidelines procedures that they must follow. What interests me in writing police characters is what they think inside beyond those protocols and processes, which I think stymie them because they're people too. Like yeah. I have a lot of negative stuff to say about the police, but I also have a lot of understanding now of the difficulties that they face. And, you know, some of their lack of investigation was heinous, but some of it was just based on cultural norms that individuals were never going to overturn. It's just the odd empathy, like Stephen Page, to actually answer a mother's letter. Those little things fascinate me, and I think they make for better fiction and much better crime fiction when we have those little human moments. So I hope that my police character, Therese Lynn, has got some hallmarks of Stephen Page, I hope.
She's got some funny moments as yeah. well. She's of Chinese origin, and somebody offers her some noodles or whatever. Is yeah. it noodles or is it something? And she goes, oh yeah, you know, that'd be right. But anyway, it is very funny. I mean, I think one of the things this book shows is that one of the best ways of revealing truth we don't want to look at is in fiction.
Yeah.
Because it gives us a narrative, and if the narrative is good, then we become involved. And you can't help but see the point of view of the people you might not want to look, you not want to look at. Yeah. In other circumstances.
I know. I've come to understand that it wouldn't matter how many articles I wrote about the gay hate crime stories, the real life stories, that in actual fact, portraying them in a crime novel stands to reach more people and to bring more understanding about the issue than journalism ever will. Because journalism kind of gives us an out. We can sort of turn away, turn the page, scroll through.
Fake news.
Yeah, and of course, yeah, there is.
We wouldn't have said that 10 years ago, yeah. But hey, you know.
Whereas a novel, I think you make an emotional contract with the reader, and you're able to, you know, it's 50-50. You allow yourself to be drawn in, and we're drawing you in at the same time.
But you have to be doing it well, and I think, in my view, you do it well. I mean, yeah. I guess writing a polemical novel, let's call it,
yes.
is a difficult thing to do.
Yeah,
I would have thought.
Because,
you know, you might think, oh, God, I can see where I'm being pulled by, like, a little ring on my nose.
Yeah.
But you don't get that feeling here. You're exploring, you're looking into things. The reader is experiencing them.
Yeah, and I don't expect you to come away thinking all gay people are good and all straight people are bad or all police are bad or it's not, nothing
all
is ever that absolute.
Are good, yeah.
All podcasters are bad or good. Yeah. There's no absolutes really. That I think that's fascinating in yeah. human nature. So yeah. it's a great privilege for me to be able to write it, have it published and talk to people about it.
Well, it's a privilege for us to listen to you, so I'm going to say thank you.
Thank you.
Can I just ask one question? Yes. You mentioned that mother who wrote every year,
yes.
asking about a death certificate.
Yeah.
Did she ever get it?
She will have now, because the Special Commission of Inquiry made recommendations. Like, you might remember the outcome for Lydia Michael Chambers, that they got an amended death certificate for Azaria in 2012 from the Northern Territory government. So the certification is really one prism through which that's actually, in a way, a stepping stone towards justice, is to get that piece of paper, which for many people is incredibly important, to be able to just have that in the family's ownership, And so the Commissioner Justice Sackar was on many occasions having death certificates issued and updated, altered, amended, and fixed. So I cannot be 100% accurate in answering you whether Kay Warren was delivered something that gave her the satisfaction that she was seeking. I would love to be able to ask her that question, and if I ever do, that will be part of my focus. But I do know that the Special Commission was empowered to fix a lot of those errors in the certification, for sure. Yeah.
Thank you. Oh, hang on, quick one.
Harassment. It just became a kind of an urban myth. Journalists, we often pick up on myths, and you've got to really do what we call triangulate the truth. So I heard that people felt she was harassing, the police felt she was harassing, and I talked to other people, is that what you've heard? Some said yes, some said no, and I thought, well, that's interesting. That shows me that we don't know the truth. So I went to source and talked to Stephen Page, eventually met him, and he said, oh, no.
One letter a year hardly constitutes harassment.
I don't even think it was one a year. I think it probably started out like that, but eventually became an occasional appeal, like,
please,
another chance. Yeah. Because I don't know if you've ever been in a position to not have a proper certificate issued for life's important things like death and marriage and birth. But, you know, these things are very important to us. And so, thank goodness she did. And, you know, I do hope one day that her story is able to be more told. Her story is in her control. And I really respect her her privacy around that.
Yeah.
But I do hope in the fullness of time that there's a way to tell her story or that she is able to share it. Perhaps it won't come ever. But perhaps what we need to do to inspire that story is to actually find out exactly what happened to her son.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, that too, yes. Yeah. Thank you very much. Now, Abby's must be somewhere.
Thank you.
I don't know where Abby's is with the books. Thank you, Sophie. So sorry to have gone on a bit longer, but we could have gone on longer still.
Thank you. Well, thank you for bearing with us going over time. I do know that.
And I would recommend, they don't have tank water because it's being reprinted. But do not worry, if you read this, you could then go back and read tank water.
You won't have spoilers.
You won't have spoilers.